recorder. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And I was just telling Bruce, I have a prayer call on Saturday morning with Maureen Muldoon and so and a group of people. And so it's just I try to get over right on time so that, you know, we're not still in the prayer call. But, you know, every week it's just like a little bit iffish. But here we are now. And did you see and hear what happened at the Course in Miracles conference this weekend, Bruce?
You know, I heard a little bit of it, but since you were there, rather than me sharing third hand or whatever hearsay, I would love to hear a detailed trip report from the San Francisco Course in Miracles conference, since I wasn't able to attend this year.
Okay, great. Well, and hopefully next year you will be able to attend. It's going to be in Boston.
Uh-huh.
And I have some tickets available that are at a discount right now. It's the actual price right now is $4.99, but I can get tickets for $4.49 with just a down payment of $149, and then you have till the end of May to pay the other $300. So anybody who's interested and wants to consider going to Boston in May of 2019, you know, let me know and I'll get you tickets. It's at the Parker House, Omni Parker House in Boston, which is a kind of legendary hotel and restaurant where they invented the Boston cream pie, which is one of my favorite things, and also they invented the Parker House roll, which is another one of my favorites. So so anyway, that's where we're going to be. And Gary Renard will be a speaker there. And let me just tell you what happened. You know, in the last few years, there's been a big rift in the community because of things that Rev Tony said about the Foundation for Inner Peace and Ken and Helen and Bill. You know, he said that, you know, I'm not going to go into it because it just makes people upset. But basically, he just was saying that it was fraudulent because there was so much that was left out. And he said that they lied because they said that they only took out personal material, but there was lots and lots of material still there that weren't put into the FIP version. And so, you know, he said those things at the conference, and I know Gary and Cindy just got up and walked out, and John Mundy got up and walked out. I got up and walked out, and I mean, it was pretty devastating to hear that kind of talk, and I was really angry about Rev Tony, and I just did not like him. I thought he was just not a very nice person, and so I personally had to go through a huge forgiveness with that, and actually learned to love Rev Tony, which is the thing that happens. You know, today's lesson, forgiveness is my function as the light of the world. When you practice forgiveness, those that you hated, you learn to love. You see their innocence. You see their guiltlessness. You see their sameness with Holy Spirit. And that's what happened. I began to see Rev Tony as a loving character and a beloved character. And then next thing you know, what happens? I get the inclination to call him up and ask him, does he want to be a part of ACIM Gather when we restarted ACIM Gather? And he said yes, and we have had this wonderful partnership for over a year now and developed a great friendship. You know, I went out to his house and visited, stayed at his place for a week last month, and just had a wonderful time with him and his roommates and everything. And you know, still there was this undercurrent of, you know, this grievance with the foundation and Gary Renard, et cetera. But, you know, he had started reaching out. Rev Tony had started reaching out to the foundation, excuse me, and had actually gotten Bob Rosenthal and Tamara Morgan to speak at the conference. So they were there. They had two sessions. It was wonderful. And So, you know, that was really just a huge leap, right? And then Rev Tony also did a fundraiser for the FIP last year to try to get some money to help them with translations and stuff. So, you know, it's like he started seeing, you know, all this as well. And so then the conference this year, at the end of the conference, they always have some little grand finale. And last year, the grand finale was in Las Vegas, and he took off his clothes. And, you know, he just stripped, and he said, you know, and I always, he just went through all the grievances that he'd had with his body his entire life, and all the shame he had about his body, and all the fear that he had about his body. And as he was talking about these things and saying, you know, he didn't like that he had, you know, kind of bulgy breasts, and, you know, he had all sorts of things that he was unhappy with, but he was bearing it to us. He was showing us, look, this is what it is. It's not a big deal. This is what it is. It's not a big deal. And, so he went all the way down to a thong kind of thing. It was pretty crazy. But, and a lot of people got up and walked out, and a lot of people were very unhappy with him for that. So this year, the grand finale, we're all kind of waiting what is going to happen here. And they brought out Rev Peter and Dusalthea came out dressed as Roman centurions, and they were so cute. And then they wheeled out a cross that these guys had built, this really, really well-constructed cross on wheels, brought it out, and he got up on the cross, and they, you know, wrapped the ropes around his arms, and then they read the list of all the things that he had done that had made everybody mad and had, you know, attacked the community and all these things. And they said, you know, and you said this about the foundation, and you said this about Helen and Bill, and he just read off all the accusations. And the whole audience is just sitting there going, crucify him, crucify him, you know, because that was part of the play, right? And then, you know, then Peter finally, after he read all the accusations, he says, well, is there no one here who would stand for this man? Which is what Pontius Pilate said about Jesus when they were getting ready. He says, there is there no one here who will stand for this man? And no one stood up for him. Well, when he said that, the curtain opened and out walked Gary Renard. And I mean, I was like instantly in tears, standing up, cheering, clapping. I was just, oh my God, this is just a miracle to me. It was just a miracle. And Gary came out and said, you know, he is innocent and has done nothing wrong. And, you know, what you're accusing him of is none of this. And, you know, he must be let go. And so it was just beautiful. I mean, I'm almost crying now thinking about it, because it was so wonderful to have that opening and that exchange, and, you know, get Tony down off that cross. You know, let's stop, you know, throwing accusations and guilt at our brothers. And so then, you know, they talked, and Gary said, yes, he's going to be a presenter at the Boston conference next year. And, you know, it's not because, you know, he lost anything by not presenting at the conference. It was because there was a true joining going on. And so, excuse me. And so, yeah, so that's what happened. It was huge. It was just huge. And I went up and talked to Gary afterwards. And, you know, I was just so, so very happy for all of this. So, yeah, it was a wonderful, wonderful situation. Sounded like Lawrence Welk. Wonderful, wonderful. But it really was pretty darn amazing when it came right down to it. So, so I'm going to be speaking, again at the conference next year, Dove and I, together. And I think we had a really great, groups that we ran, and it was all about giving everybody the power. So in our groups, we did not have, you know, it wasn't Dove and Lynn standing up talking to a group of people. We actually made them get into groups and circles, and each one of them had to speak. And so we had everyone was the teacher. Every person was the teacher in our sessions. And the point was to prove that you can be a teacher of God no matter what you think about yourself or what you know about the course, even if you're just new to it, that your dedication to that book is what made you already a teacher of God. And so we were encouraging people to join us here on Gather, and a lot of people have expressed interest in doing that. So, you know, it just was a wonderful, wonderful experience, and I do encourage anyone who wants to go next year to let me know, and I'll try to, you know, work out a deal for tickets for you. But, you know, what a wonderful forgiveness opportunity it was, and what a wonderful miracle. Actually, it was that all that happened the way it did. Because I'm telling you what, I talked to Tony till my, you know, my jaw was breaking about, you know, you got to give up this grievance against Ken and the foundation, and you know, you just got to give up this grievance. It's killing you. And so when that happened, of course, you know, I take responsibility because, you know, I was the one telling him that, and the only person in the world that was telling him to.
I have some inside information that suggests that you were one of multiple contributors. Let's put it that way. So
I'm thinking probably so. Yeah.
but anyway,
was what I wanted, so it made me really happy. Yeah. And so yeah, I'm really grateful. And there will be there is a video that will be going out into onto YouTube of that whole thing. So
you'll have an opportunity. I'll look forward to seeing that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll send you a link once I see it, or let you know when it comes up. But
please do, yes.
It was like the prodigal son. I swear to God, it was like the prodigal son. When you know, and I'm not sure which one of them was the prodigal. Was it Tony or was it Gary? Because, you know, both of them, you know, had their grievances, but they both gave them up in... and it just was such a joyful experience. So, yeah. Excuse me. And I got a little bit of a cold, so hoping I don't. Excuse me. I'm going to mute my mic and we can go and find where we start. Where we're reading and start reading if you would like to do that.
Sure. Sure. Let's see. Did I unmute my mic? Hold on. Yeah, I did. Okay, looks like I did. Okay, yeah. Good. So I want to make sure before I started talking. Well, thank you, Lynn, very much for sharing that. I like I say, I wasn't able to attend this particular time, but for a number of reasons. But anyway, this is the third first-hand trip report I've gotten, so and it corroborates with the other two shared with me. So that's really fun that, and very healing as I've heard before that, you know, this was an opportunity to express, true forgiveness, which is that nothing ever happened, and how appropriate that Gary Renard would share that, since that, you know, he's been such a catalyst for so many people to really understand the true meaning of forgiveness, along with Ken Wapnick and of course, both of the sister foundations anyway, just lots of fun things that have happened in the last couple of weeks, and including there's a new Foundation for A Course in Miracles website, which has a wonderful glossary that's got links to you know all the different words that appear in the course that you know need redefinition from our conventional formal religious background, and so you know all those words are hot linked and everything, so. If you haven't been to the new facim.org website, I encourage everyone to check it out. Other progress in other areas of you know, the FIP website, which I'll get into more detail as as we get closer to launching it. But anyway, yeah, I heard lots of good things about the conference, and I'm sure all the presentations were wonderful. I always enjoy those, and certainly all the hallway, you know, meeting, not just the meeting room events, but the you know the informal conversations that happen at those conferences, and the friendships that are either reestablished from virtual ones, and or begun anew. So, anyway, it's always fun to hear about. What transpires at those events, and like you say, it's really all about letting go of what what never happened, and that's really the only way that forgiveness works, isn't it? So let's see, what else was I going to share? I appreciate everything you shared about that. I was just thinking as you were sharing, it's like, yep. So I guess what I can do, I think I have us on chapter 3. I think we might have just started chapter 3.
I got us marked where we start in a state of non-dualism, which Lao Tzu understood.
Okay.
So I'm sure, looks like page 40 on my, page but 40? I'm on the Kindle, so I don't
okay.
know.
Okay. Should we just back up a couple pages to the?
Absolutely. Let's
start
do
chapter
that.
Three? I think it's been a while. It's been a while, and this will give the context, yeah. So, again, Lynn and I for some time have been reading slowly but surely Gary Renard's fourth book, his latest one, which is The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, A History of Mighty Companions. And so the introduction took several weeks to read, and the note from the author. And we've read the first two chapters. Now we're into the third one. We actually read a couple pages the last time we conversed, but that might be worth reviewing. So this is the third chapter in Gary's fourth book, and the title is A Time as Hindus. And there's an introductory quote at the beginning of the chapter from the Bhagavad Gita. I think I'm saying that right, but I'm not sure. And it goes, there are two eternal paths. One is light, the other is dark. The first leads to freedom from the wheel of death and rebirth. The other leads you here again. The real never is not. The unreal never is, which I think, as we pointed out before, sounds a whole lot like the introductory opening words to the course, nothing real can be threatened, nothing unreal exists, and with the addition of herein lies the peace of God. So it begins in terms of the narrative. Many years ago, when I first heard the above quote from the Bhagavad Gita spoken at a spiritual conference, I couldn't help notice, but it was saying, there are only two things to choose between, not many. There are only two paths, and each one leads to a very specific result. I liked the simplicity of that. I had also heard that the ancient Hindu Advaita Vedanta was so named because the words meant the end of knowledge. I thought that was pretty cool. Most Western approaches pride themselves on their abundance of knowledge, and here's something that sees the end of knowledge as a good thing. I was interested. It wasn't until many years later that I would find out these ideas were associated with something called non-dualism. Early on my spiritual journey, I didn't even know what that was. The words Lao Tzu had spoken reminded me of something Cindy once said, quote, I have nothing to do but everything to be. That's the end of the quote. I thought that was brilliant, but Cindy herself would be the first one to say it doesn't necessarily mean you don't do anything. At one point, A Course in Miracles says, quote, I need do nothing, unquote. Many students misinterpret that to mean you're not supposed to do anything, which is what the course would call level confusion. The important part is that you need, the emphasis on the word need, and italics there, do nothing. You don't have to. If you think you have to, it involves bodily identification. So one must put the entire quote in context and also bring in the course's essential time-saving aspect of forgiveness. How appropriate, since you're just sharing that story about Gary in San Francisco. When peace comes at last to those who wrestle with temptation, fight against the giving into sin, when the light comes at last into the mind given to contemplation, or when the goal is finally achieved by anyone, it always comes with just one happy realization. I need do nothing. Here is the ultimate release, which everyone will one day find in his own way at his own time. You do not need this time. Time has been saved for you because you and your brother are together. This is the special means this course is using to save you time. You are not making use of this course if you insist on using means which have served others well, neglecting what was made for you. Save time for me by only this one preparation and practice doing nothing else. I need do nothing is a statement of allegiance, a truly undivided loyalty. Believe it for just one instant, and you will accomplish more than is given to a century of contemplation or of struggle against temptation. To do anything involves the body. And if you recognize you need do nothing, you have withdrawn the body's value from your mind. Here is the quick and open door through which you slip past centuries of effort and escape from time. It goes on to say, to do nothing is to rest and to make a place within you where the activity of the body ceases to demand attention. Into this place the Holy Spirit comes and there abides. He will remain when you forget, and the body's activities return to occupy your conscious mind. Yet there will always be this place of rest to which you can return. And you will be more aware of this quiet center of the storm than all its raging activity. This quiet center in which you do nothing will remain with you, giving you rest in the midst of every busy doing on which you are sent.
And that brings
back up to where we left off.
Okay, yeah, that does. And you know what? That is so brilliant. Because this whole idea of I need do nothing, it puts you in the midst of this center of calmness. And the thought that I need to do something either comes from a past idea, thought that happened, or something that I learned or saw or thought happened. You know, I see these things in the past, and so I'm all busily trying to prepare myself so that it doesn't happen again, or that it does happen again, or that, you know, I have all these thoughts that I can take what seems to have happened in the past and project it into the future, and therefore by be more prepared for what's going to happen, or, you know, maybe make a change in what's going to happen. You know, I have all these ideas that I'm in control of something other than my own thinking. And so I use that time in the middle to try to regulate things. But the fact is, in that center where there is no past and there is no future, you know, get into that place. There is a place where you can get into where you think, you know, that the past and the future are real and you have to do something to manage that. But go beyond that to a place where I am in this place right now and there is no place else to go, nothing else to do. There is no past. There's nothing to remember. You know, I don't have to sit here and think, if only I had said this, or if I had caught an earlier flight, or if, you know, this person hadn't have done this, or, you know, stop thinking about the past as being any kind of example or any kind of a teaching that's going to prepare you for a future, because the past is imaginary. It's only in your mind. It doesn't exist now. It's gone. And the future is the same. It's in your mind only. It doesn't really exist. It's imaginary. It will never happen the way you anticipate. You will never get exactly what you think you're going to get. You're never going to go exactly where you think you're going to go. No one's ever going to do exactly what you think they're going to do, because you have no idea. We have no insight into that part of the script. The only part of the script we have insight into is this moment now. And so this whole idea of I need do nothing really is true, because things will happen whether I do it or not. Things will happen whether I'm involved or not. The script is written. These things are going to happen. I have no choice about it. So for me, and this may not help other people, this may be terrible to other people to think about, but to me, when I gave up the idea that somehow I could manage the future and that I could control what was going to happen, and just gave in and recognized, go with the flow and let the Spirit carry me through, then I stop planning. I stop being upset when my plans don't come through, and I stop imagining that somehow I know something about something that doesn't even exist. You know, God doesn't even know the future. Do you know that? God does not know the future. Why? Can you think of one reason why God does not know the future? Because it doesn't exist. God doesn't know anything that's not real. So, you know, all these little petty things that we think are happening in our little world, you know, God is completely has no notion of it. because that would make it a tragedy. If God knew that all this shit was going on in my mind and somehow let me just go on thinking these things or doing these things, then he'd be pretty bad God. But he doesn't know because it doesn't exist. It only exists in my imagination. And God is not aware of my imaginary thoughts. God is only aware of the truth of what I am and the truth of what you are. So God is in this moment now. You know, God isn't in the past. God isn't saying, oh, you should have done this or you shouldn't have done that. That's ego. You know, God isn't saying you better try this or protect yourself in some way because the future is going to be bad. That's ego. God knows you're perfectly safe sleeping and dreaming in heaven. That's what God knows. And so he's not responsible for my dream. And the only one who's responsible for that is me. So anyway, that's enough talk about time and God and what he does or doesn't know. Just the fact that I need do nothing should be enough to say that everything is perfect, just the way it is. And my involvement is not required or even wanted. In fact, the less I'm involved with thoughts of the future or thoughts of the past, the happier I am. So, okay. Well, I'm going to start reading the next paragraph.
Okay. Before you do, I was just going to make a couple of comments on the, you know, the whole nature of time is we have, it seems like we have it backwards so much of the time, that, you know, if the ego speaks first and all this is wrong, and that's the default that we turn to unless we're more mindful, then our use of time, is obviously, it's not evil or sinful or wicked. It's just silly because we basically, as you say, we invest a lot of preoccupation and obsession in the future, in a fearful future, and in a you know, a sinful past. And so the only thing that's left is it really makes that kind of glues the insanity together of the ego's thought system is the guilty present. So, you know, this whole sin, guilt, and fear is, you know, past, present, and future misery that that Holy Spirit, a.k.a. our inner kindness teacher, a.k.a. any symbol that represents that awareness that we took with us into the dream, can then lead us out of that insanity. And then the right use of time is really to remember the eternity of now. But we don't usually get to that directly. I think we just need to as A Course in Miracles suggests, continuously, remember that, our function is forgiveness as the light of the world. And to practice that, we need to just look at whatever is, involved in, you know, and whenever it's coming up for us in terms of our sensory data and the ego's interpretation of that, we just need to look at that and begin to gently laugh at it. Not necessarily outward and acoustically, but inwardly just say, wow, here is this incredibly elaborate dream that involves time and space that I made up in order to keep me from a perfect awareness of love that is beyond anything I can possibly imagine. And that awareness can really undo our misconceptions of time, can it? I mean, it basically gives us, it frees us from the sin in the past because we see that nothing happened. If space and time and bodies and individuality and separation, substitution and specialness, all those S's are just figments of our imagination of a really a fearful dream. And the guilt and the fear then just fall away, because if you don't connect the past and the future in the present, there's really nothing to keep those illusions intact in our mind, and they just fall away. So by being present with which thought system we're choosing now, each now, we begin to gradually release our grip on the insanity of the ego and realize that we are free at every moment to choose peace instead of this being ego's version of this. it's misinterpretation. So anyway, thank you for all that you shared, and it's I think it fits really nicely into what we're reading.
Well, thank you. All right. So I'll go ahead and read the next paragraph. And, you know, as always, I think we're going to learn more, because, you know, it is interesting. I love Gary's work and I love these books and how clear and simple they are. It's, you know, kind of amazing when you start seeing it. And that's why people love Gary Renard and his books, and people so excited to see him and so happy. You know, of course, there's a few people that are like, oh, yeah, no, Gary Renard, he's a jerk. But, you know, that's, you know, up to them. They can feel that way if they want to. You know, I particularly am incredibly grateful. And you know, it's really sweet. You know, when I was talking to Gary, he said, you know, Lynn, he says, I consider you one of my true friends. He said, you've been with me since the beginning, and you never wavered. And, even with all the other crap, and I'm sure there were many, many, many people who were with him from the beginning and never wavered, but it did make me feel really, you know, special, being, you know, loved by Gary like that, because I love him too. So it works that way. All right, so in a state of non-dualism, which Lao Tzu understood, no part of the illusion was accorded reality, nor did the truth include any illusion. The truth and illusions were mutually exclusive, a fact that is lost on almost everyone. You know, well, duh, truth and illusion are mutually exclusive, but boy, we sure don't see that, right? Instead, as my teacher said, people always try to make the illusion, or at least part of it, true. This would also involve the attempt to bring whoever people thought was the creator or creators of the universe into the illusion by making that deity responsible for it. One of the most common New Age beliefs is that God created One of the most common New Age beliefs is that God created the dualistic universe so he could experience himself. And we've all heard that. I've heard that by a lot of course teachers will say this crap. Mm-hmm. And it's like, what, have you read this book? No. But the insanity of that idea is almost never questioned. It's like saying that in order to enjoy, appreciate, and experience the orgasmic joy of sex, you have to shoot yourself in the stomach so you'll have a dualistic experience to compare it to. You know, Gary's got good examples. But God is not insane. The truth is a constant state. And as both the Course and the Bible have said, God is still perfect love. This dream world is the opposite of perfect, but the reality of God gives us a perfect home to go home to. To go home to that real world, however, one has to wake up from this one. There are not two real worlds. The math of non-dualism is very simple. It always comes out to one. And, yeah, this whole concept of the real world and people having this idea that in the real world where it's going to be just like this world, only better. Well, he has a lot of stuff to say about the real world. And he says, you know, when you get to the point where you're actually in tune with this and you really do see things through Christ's vision, then this world that you see will just appear like a shadow. And the light is all that you will see. And the truth and reality of what is there is all that you see. Even a blind person who has physical blindness in their eyes will see in the real world, because you're seeing with a truth that is not based on the physical, any physical requirement. So, this idea that people have that, you know, we're going to come to a real world where it's all going to be nice and springy and sunny. And it reminds me of and the lions laying down with the lambs. It reminds me of a Jehovah Witness pamphlet. You know, I don't know if the Jehovah Witness ever come to your house and they give you this pamphlet and it shows people living in paradise. And it's just like this world, only it's, you know, lions are laying down with lambs. Well, that's not what the real world is going to look like. You know, Jesus is pretty clear about that. If you read the Savior's vision in chapter 31, you know, he says, you're not going to see this crap in these bodies and these beings that you think are there. You're going to see the truth and reality of them, and it's going to blow you away, because you're not going to, you're going to see things that you never knew existed. You know, the idea that, you know, we're going to get, because Jesus does talk about, you know, when you do all this, you'll get into this place called the real world and everything will be much better. But it's not because, you know, all of a sudden you're in some happy paradise where birds and butterflies and lions and lambs. It's because you are in a state of mind in which you are not in conflict with the thoughts of God. And the world we see is a conflict with the thoughts of God. The world of flesh and bodies and the illusion is in conflict with the thoughts of God, because it implies that there is more than one being. And God's thought is that we are all one. There is one being. And that includes everything and everyone. And so there's not one or the other. There's only the one. So, you know, this is hard for people to understand. And even people who think that they know and understand non-dualism still trip over that and make those same mistakes, because the ego can't see it. But, you know, Jesus is real clear. You can't be in both worlds at one time. Mm-hmm. You are either going to be in one or the other. And for the most part, the one we're going to be in is the one that we believe is true. So, you know, as long as I believe this world is true, I can never see the real world. It's impossible. Just as when I see the truth of what is, I will never see this world again. It will not appear to me as it appears right now. It did not appear to Jesus as it appears right now to me. And that's really what I want.
I think it's also important to point out that we don't have to worry about going poof, as Ken Wapnick says. You know, it's not like we're going to study the course and practice it and then, you know, just, you know, some afternoon, you know, while we're having a sip of tea, that suddenly the universe just winks out and there's nothing that's familiar. I think it's a very gradual, gentle process where we practice forgiveness, where we undo our misinterpretations by choosing against the ego, choosing against the duality, and slowly but surely we as again, like how Ken and Gary's work reinforces each other, and one of the things that Ken says is, you know, the purpose of the course is not to make us miserable. The purpose is to see how miserable we have been as a result of choosing the ego as our teacher, and how, you know, utterly, you know, desolate and despicable and unfun the results of that choice have been for us, and to just really be completely honest with us. And Jesus says, you know, we need to be really honest with each other. And then, as Ken points out, he is probably, you know, there probably isn't any dishonesty on Jesus's part that we need to be concerned about. It's really us withholding, you know, we need to, you know, fess up and come forth with the stuff that we are harboring, which is really, I think, you know, part of that, you know, conversation about level confusion, as Gary was talking about here, that if we can, you know, look at our attempts to try to make this dream world work for us and see really factually, you know, I'm going to share a quote that I don't think I can attribute to, but I've heard first from Susan Dugan is, you know, how's that working out for you? If we can just kind of honestly, you know, recognize how the ego's curriculum isn't working out for us, and then we can let go of it. Since you mentioned the lion and the lamb, a few moments ago, I had to laugh when I remembered, I think it was Woody Allen who said, you know, the lion shall lay down with the lamb, but the lamb won't get much sleep. Anyway, I just thought that was kind of fun. Shall I go on and read a little more? I don't hear you, so I think I'm just
Mike. Yeah.
Okay. I'll continue on with where we left off. And this is page 41, middle of the page, in Gary Renard's fourth book. Since the fall of 2013, when my third book, Love Is Forgot, No One, was published, I had continued to travel all over the world teaching the course, most of the time with Cindy as my co-presenter. I noticed an interesting phenomenon involving my dreams in bed at night. I knew ACIM was saying that all minds are joined. That's true because ultimately there is only one mind, really just one of us that thinks it's here. That's why psychic phenomena are possible. A good psychic or medium has the ability to, quote, tap in, unquote, to seemingly split off parts of the mind and receive messages and information. As the years of traveling went on, I noticed my dreams at night could be influenced by the number of people in the area. It was, if I was in a quiet place like Cedar Rapids, Iowa, my dreams were usually very peaceful and tranquil, except in the rare event there was someone close by who was in a condition of great conflict. On the other hand, if I was in a big city like Guangzhou, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, China, which has 13 million people, I'd often have active, chaotic dreams that sometimes included violence. As I slept, my mind was actually tuning into the minds of others in the area. A happy corollary of that is that because minds are joined, if your mind is becoming more peaceful and is having right-minded thoughts with the Holy Spirit, you cannot help but be some kind of a helpful influence on those around you. The Course teaches that the simple presence of a teacher of God acts as a reminder. At some level, you're getting through to people's minds, whether you realize it or not. That doesn't mean that you can do their forgiveness work for them. They still have to do their part, but you can point them in the right direction. Many students in history have thought they could become enlightened simply by living in the presence of a master, that somehow his or her enlightenment would rub off on them, like catching a virus or something. That would be nice. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. Whether 2,600 years ago or today, the ego must be undone, and that takes discipline. You want to pick up from there?
Sure. And you know, people think that, and will go to gurus and teachers who will give them this like samadhi, or, you know, they somehow or the other can get them into a state of mind in which they feel an enlightenment, or they feel a being in the one mind, or whatever it is. I'm not sure. But they do, and I think it's through kind of a process of hypnosis, because really no one can give you anything. That there's nothing outside of yourself. Mm-hmm. There is no other entity that's going to be able to give me a spiritual gift or a peace of mind or whatever. Even Jesus, when people came up to Jesus and asked for healing, or even at one point, you know, someone just touched his robe and she was healed, and he didn't even know who it was. He just felt that presence and said, "Who just touched me?" Because it came to him as well. You know, it was through her faith that healing came, not through Jesus' power, that he was, you know, being the almighty Son of God and, you know, out there healing people. He was doing nothing other than being what he was, and that people were getting what they did from him, not from him, but from their own internal teacher, who has the same exact makeup and power, is exactly the same as the Christ. It is the Christ. And so no one can give you that. You have it already. It's what you are. So the only thing that another person can maybe do is point out to you, or show you, or be an example to you of a different way of seeing things. And when Jesus tells us in the Course that enlightenment is just a shift in perception, it's a change in our mind, you know, that really is what happens, is a change of mind, a shift in perception that causes these things to happen, not the power of a guru. And yes, they may go into some kind of mass hypnosis whereupon they believe that this is happening to them. And you can see that. I don't know if you have, if this is on anymore, but, well, I know it's not on anymore because the guy's dead. But when I was young, my grandma used to watch this guy, Oral Roberts, on TV on Sunday mornings, and there would be all these people that would come to him, and, you know, they would come up and he would put his hand on their head and say, heal, you know, and then they would be healed. They would, you know, have had cancer, and then they'd have sudden, you know, ill, or they'd be on crutches and they'd put the crutches down and dance around on the stage, and, you know, all kinds of stuff was happening. Well, you know, that's, first off, the idea that you are sick is a form of hypnosis. It is a mental state in which I believe that I'm something that I'm not. And so, you know, I'm already susceptible to ideas like that. So then when I go to see this famous healer, I've already opened my mind to the idea that I may be healed because this is, you know, what this guy does. And I've already proven the power of the ego to fool me by being sick in the first place. So, you know, all I'm doing is just falling into the hands of the ego over and over and over when I go to see these teachers who seem to have some kind of power or act as if they have some sort of power. You know, they may not even know themselves that they are, that they're fooling people. But they have to have some sort of notion at some point that they are not capable of the kinds of miracles, quote unquote, that people seem to have to receive when they're around them. Because there really is only one power, and, you know, there's only one thing here. You know, no person can do or not do. Anyway.
That reminds me of, the first person I would call my spiritual teacher, about around 1970, when I was in high school, actually, and, named Floyd Edwards, and he said something that struck me as credible, even then early on in my, you know, quest for understanding, or maybe de-understanding the world or disinterpreting the world. Anyway, he said, you can't teach anyone anything they don't already know. And, that was, you know, one of his introductory comments for every class that he would conduct. And I thought, well, that seems right on, because if someone has something that you don't have, in truth, then, you know, we're all doomed, because that means that somehow, you know, the access is limited, or there's a finite supply of opportunities to do what seems to be our predicament. So I think that, you know, right there was an early precursor to recognizing, like you say, there's only one of us in the room. There's, you know, ultimately pure non-duality is the only thing that really makes sense. And all these processes, and particularly forgiveness being the gateway practice that opens up our mind to the idea that we're all into this together, and that the sameness leads to the oneness that we never left. That's can be very helpful, can it? So anyway. Please go on. Thank you.
Okay. So, let's see. Okay. So am I on many students in history? Did I read?
I'm on page 42, about the middle. Arton, okay. I see you've been entertaining yourself with the news.
Okay, yeah, I need to turn the page.
Oh,
okay.
Actually, just a paragraph before that, I think.
Okay. Yeah. The next time my ascended friend showed up, I'd been watching some news shows on CNN and MSNBC and trying to forgive what I saw. Oh, man, this is my everyday life. that effort was helped by the fact that the news had become more comical, almost cartoon-like. I'm telling you, when he was writing this book, you didn't even understand the idea of how comical and cartoon-like the news could become. Because, you know, now I just watch it and just, I'm amazed at what seems to be happening. He says, yes, there's tremendous tragedy in the movie Illusion we call life, but it's making it real that makes it painful. Arton began the conversation. Arton, I see you've been entertaining yourself with the news. And entertaining is the word. That's fine as long as you remember what it's for. And after all, everybody loves a circus. Gary, I know, I can't believe Donald Trump is doing good. Arton, then don't believe it. Gary, oh yeah. Persa, today we're going to give you a glimpse of a very interesting part of JMB's history together, and that's Jesus and Buddha as they spent time as Hindus. This was a leap forward for them. Later, they'd also know each other as Buddhists at the very beginning of what would become Buddhism. So you should realize that Buddhism is kind of like Hinduism without all the gods. Monotheism, the belief that there's only one God, wasn't popularized until Judaism, then later Christianity and Islam. By the way, all three of those faiths have the same God, the God of Abraham. But before those religions, you usually had at least a few gods for different purposes. Gary, like the Greek gods? Persa. Yes, the Hindus and the Greeks probably had the most gods, and Buddhism focused on the mind. By the way, we'll be talking a little about Buddhism later, but you should realize, since we're going to be talking about Hinduism now, that at first Buddhism was considered to be a part of Hinduism, like a sect, just as Christianity originally considered itself to be a part of Judaism, not something separate from it. Also, Buddhism never really caught on very much in India. It was only when it spread to China that it took off, as you would say. Gary, yeah, it's hard to have a hit. Artin, one accurate thing you could say about Hinduism and its history is that it's complicated, so we're not going to be getting into all the different books and schools of thoughts. Hindus believe that many of their gods, including Krishna, can be traced back at least 3,200 years. That can't be confirmed, but that's the belief. Some of the philosophy in the Advaita Vedanta also goes back before recorded history. You may recall we told you long ago that even though the original idea behind it was non-dualistic, it was incorrectly interpreted by some of Shankara's followers as being dualistic, and that's how a large segment of Hindus eventually came to think of it. That's par for the course. By the way, you said it was Shankara who misinterpreted, but that was a mistake. It was some of his students who got it wrong and passed it along. We want to tell you a little about JMB and a lifetime they shared around 500 BC. That was about 100 years after their experience with Lao Tzu. Their names were Harish and Pamaj. No need to give their full names. They were cousins and neighbors in a fairly large village. They were raised to be devout Hindus, but Harish felt the temptation to have worldly experiences. This is where you want to realize that people are thrown by the ego to be a certain way. People are thrown by the ego to be a certain way. It's like throwing a pot, maybe a potter making a pot on a wheel. They are the way that they are because that's the way they're supposed to be in order to have the experiences they've been set up for. And they don't know why, because it's all unconscious.
Sounds like a script to me.
Yeah, it sounds like a script to me. And we get to be the characters and, gee, when we're the characters in the script, then whatever the script tells us to do, we do it. And, you know, that happens to everyone all the time. You know, you never get out of the script until you actually remember the truth of who you are and go vertical, you know, get off the horizontal track and go vertical and think with the Holy Spirit. And when you think with the Holy Spirit, you know, if that's your only thought, then you are no longer caught up in the world of time and space and flesh and bodies. When you remember God, which is what happens, then you become identified with the Christ. And identified with the Christ, you have no limitation. Okay.
Yeah,
so
it's above the battleground, isn't it? When you really are looking at the dream figures, including yourself, and realizing that the only way you can, you know, be a participant in a script is to be a character in a dream or a play or a movie or whatever the metaphor you like is, and recognizing, hopefully simultaneously, that because you're recognizing and seeing that for what it is, as you know, an illusory drama being reenacted that was over long ago, then the reality, which is outside of space and time, is really that awareness is what's watching that, and that awareness is what is being recultivated and reintegrated and restored as our true identity that is not subject to time, space, change, and all the ego whims, right?
Exactly. And so that, I mean, that's exactly what happens then. And that's what happened to Jesus. And so that's why all those things could happen to him. And he wasn't, you know, running around saying, oh, please save me and don't crucify me and all that. He was like, well, okay, this is a script. You know, this is what I'm supposed to do at this very moment, at this very time. And, you know, there's no need to reject that. You know, when the whole idea of the Garden of Gethsemane and him, you know, kneeling in there saying, you know, please take this away from me and all that crap, you know, who heard that? All his disciples were sleep drunk and passed out, basically. They didn't even come into the garden with him. He's in there all by himself talking to his father. Who heard that and recorded that? Or did he come out and say, oh, by the way, just in case you're wondering what was going on, I was in there begging God for my life. No, that's not what was happening. That would be absurd. You know, so this whole thing of take this cup away from me and you know, all that stuff, you know, that's a made up story. And I mean, the proof of it would be right there. Who would have heard it to write it down? Nobody. But it's ridiculous to think that he would think these things, because he, at that point, knew that the script was written and he was going through with whatever it said, because not because he wanted to or he thought it was a good idea, but because that is the path to salvation. That's where the Holy Spirit went through and put salvation behind everything in the story. So, you know, he had no choice. He wasn't sad. He wasn't mad. He wasn't holding a grudge against God for, you know, giving him this terrible cup to drink. He was like, well, you know, that's just the way it is, and let's get on with it. So I'm going to continue reading, unless you want to read from, let's say you were born today in Canada.
I can start up there. Sure.
Okay.
And just as you're saying that, I was, you know, the last few comments, I was thinking that you know, it really is always a choice as to, you know, what thought system. And anyway, it's all, you know, the script is always can be interpreted two ways, and ego's ways, a way that keeps us imprisoned and stuck as characters in the dream rather than figures in the dream rather than the dreamer. So. Okay, it continues. Let's say you were born in Canada, and when you're 6 years old, you start playing the game of hockey. Of course, you don't know why, you just love it. You keep playing, and over the years, you get really good at it, good enough that one day you become a professional player. Nothing in the world interests you as much as the game. Yes, you have a personal life, but it's the sport that enthralls you. This happens because it's supposed to, and this is the way it is with all people, their professions and the things they're most interested in. They're thrown to live out a script, and nothing can stop it. Persa, do you remember when you were 12 and you were at a friend's house, and he took you into his father's room and opened up a case that had a gun in it? Gary, oh my God, I hadn't thought about that in ages. Persa, how did you feel when you saw the gun? Gary, I was scared, really scared. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. My friend, I won't say his name, probably thought I'd be fascinated with it, like him, and that I'd want to play with it. But I got the hell out of there as fast as I could. Persa, why do you think you felt that way? Gary, I don't know. I guess it was unconscious. Persa, precisely. So there are two things you should know about that. First, in your previous dream lifetime, you were killed fighting in World War II. The horror of war was deeply imprinted in your unconscious, and a gun was the last thing you wanted to see. Second, it was because of your experience in that war in your previous lifetime that you didn't have to go to war in this lifetime. That wasn't an experience you'd have to have again right away. Gary, you mean that's why when I was 19 they switched over to the draft lottery and my number was high so that I didn't get drafted and sent to Vietnam? Persa, yes, come to think of it, have you ever fired a gun in your life? Gary, no, I never have. Persa, and you never will. It's not something you're supposed to do this time. On the other hand, your friend who showed you the weapon remained fascinated with guns and practiced using them whenever he could. Eventually, he decided to make the military his career. However, he ended up getting killed in Vietnam. Gary, I didn't know that. I didn't stay in touch with him after that gun episode. Persa. You weren't supposed to. Eventually, because of the path you've chosen, you'll remember that World War II experience of being killed and be able to forgive it. Then you'll be free of it. Gary, you're saying that what happens is already predetermined, but I still have the power to practice forgiveness at the level of the mind and be free of feeling the uncomfortable effects of whatever happens. Oh, that's a statement, rather, not a question. I'll read that again. Gary, you're saying that whatever happens is already predetermined, but I still have the power to practice forgiveness at the level of the mind and be free of feeling the uncomfortable effects of whatever happens. Persa, excellent. And even though the purpose of forgiveness is not to change the script, but instead to be free of its effects, it's also possible within a fixed system for the Holy Spirit to adjust time and space for you. You may then have a different experience than you would have. But that's up to the Holy Spirit. Your job is to do the forgiveness work. The Holy Spirit knows if it's appropriate for you to change dimensions of time. And I'll stop there for a moment and comment on that. In another study group, we were talking about this idea of predestination and I think, and in free will and you know, shifting essentially the, you know, alternate reality, if you will, or alternate dimension or time track or whatever. I think that the script always works within, you know, as a, like a Newtonian model within each dimension of time, as I understand it, but forgiveness helps us make quantum jumps to different dimensions where our different script can play out. But the important thing, as always, is to be really alert to the whole temptation of the ego to jump in and do a level of confusion, and kind of like you were talking about earlier, to, you know, try to imagine a world where lions and lambs get along and politicians are always honest, and you know, not that those aren't worthwhile goals and whatnot, but if we can just remember, it's not about fixing up this world. It's not about putting our dream repair technician hats on and going out on some holy crusade and fixing the world. You know, it's as the title of Gary's first book suggests, you know, the idea is for us to be so peaceful that we won't have any need for the world, and that is what causes the disappearance of the universe, not blowing it up or fleeing it in some way physically. It's we basically just realize that the investment in that kind of self-inflicted punishment no longer has any appeal for us. So anyway, please go on.
and you know, that it's really interesting what we're talking about here, this whole idea of dimensions of time. And it's easy for me when I think about it, because when I think about what happened when the script was written and the Tiny Matt idea, was that we actually put out every possible scenario that could happen to every possible scenario that could happen that if we were actually able to be separate from God. And so it could be the possible scenario that Lynn goes through her life and has all these terrible things happen, and then gets cancer, and then goes through chemo and has all these things go on, and then eventually it doesn't work, and eventually, you know, she goes into some kind of terrible, you know, spin and ends up dying from this disease. That's a possibility. That's in, you know, that's just because I just mentioned it. I know that it's a possibility in the script, because I can't imagine anything that hasn't already been imagined in the Tiny Matt idea. Every possible scenario was imagined at that time. So that means that Lynn has dimensions of a life wherein she doesn't get cancer and she, you know, lives to a happy old age, or she becomes president of the United States, or, you know, there are all these scenarios that could be possibly happening. And what happens is, if you do not awaken completely from the dream, you're still living in a dream state, and yet you're practicing your forgiveness and letting go of your belief in the reality of it. It shifts you in dimension, in time and space, from the lessons that you would have had to learn, like being in war or having a disease or whatever. And in fact, I had this scenario happen that you'll understand my odd way of thinking here, is that last year when I was, trying to get insurance and trying to, you know, find some insurance, I signed up with this guy, and You know, he's really a nice man, and he got me hooked up on dental insurance, and which I didn't know, accident and life insurance, that if I had an accident, that they would pay, you know, whatever for it, like Aflac or something. But
let me guess, this wasn't Ned Ryerson, right?
No, it wasn't Ned Ryerson.
Groundhog Day movie?
I would have bought all the insurance from that. Okay. But it wasn't like that, right?
Okay, so
I got that. And then, you know, I was trying to figure out my finances and trying to, because I have some dental work that I need to get done. And I noticed these two insurance policies that I had forgotten about completely. So I called them up, and yes, the dental insurance, not only was it in effect, but after a year of having it, I could go on and get major dental work, which is what I really need. And so that was, wow, you know, I'm going to be able to get my teeth fixed. The other one, though, was accident and life insurance. And I thought, you know, there's no need for me to have that. And so I called them up and canceled it. And in canceling it, they said, okay, well, it's in effect till the 1st of March. So, you know, until the 1st of March, I have this insurance that would pay if I got an accident. And so the mind of Lynn started thinking, well, does that mean I'm going to get into an accident? Is that what's, you know, going to happen here because of this? Is this here to help me in case that happens? And I thought, well, that's bullshit. I'm not going to have an accident. You know, not because I don't will to have an accident, but I don't believe I need that experience. And, you know, I'm asking you, Holy Spirit, to, you know, affirm to me, I don't need the experience of having an accident and having that insurance paid off, because I'll take it some other way. You know, offer me this lesson in another way. You know, there are gentler ways that we can learn these lessons, and we don't have to be, you know, in a car wreck in order to do that. So, you know, I'm willing, and that's all I said, Holy Spirit, I'm willing to learn whatever lesson it is that I need to learn. You know, I don't necessarily need the pain. You know, I'm willing, and I don't need the pain. If you're not willing, you need the pain. The pain will make you willing. But if you, it'll come to where I'm in so much pain, I want to change. But if you're willing to learn the lesson, you can ask for that. Show me a better way, and you can have a better experience. Now, you'll never be able to prove that. You won't be able to go back and say, well, if I hadn't have done that, then, you know, this would have happened. You just know, I didn't have an accident. I never used that insurance. All is perfect. You can do that with any lesson in your life. You know, if you think you have cancer, tell the Holy Spirit, tell yourself, I'm willing to learn whatever lesson this is. And I'm willing to take the pain if that's what is necessary, but I don't need the pain to be willing. And if that's all the pain is for, which I believe that's the only purpose of pain in this experience, is to make us willing to see a better way or have a better way, you know, I don't need that. I already want a better way, and I'm already willing to see it differently. So, whatever it is, you know, I'm not going to cry about it if it happens, but I'm definitely going to tell you that I don't need to suffer in order to remember the truth of who I am and the truth of who my brother is. You know, that's just my thought. But I think
we don't have to. It's very common for us to get our backs against the wall, and then like you say, and that. You know, precipitates there must be a better way kind of thing, as we did with Helen and Bill. But we don't have to. It's not required. It's just that that's the norm, because we're so, you know, invested in trying to make the world work. And eventually we discover that all of, you know, ego's choices are dead ends and blind alleys and lead nowhere. They're box canyons or whatever metaphor you like. They're all, you know, fruitless, searches. Well, I was thinking of one of Ken's audios, you know, the, from Futility to Happiness, where he talks about the myth of Sisyphus, you know, pushing the rock up the hill. You know, the rock's always going to come back down and in the ego's dream. But there is a place where there is peace that is where Sisyphus finally realizes, I'm not here. I mean, that's that. How do you find joy in a joyless place? Is by recognizing that you're not here. So the only question I had about your dental insurance is if I were to assume a person from the Indian subcontinent and a persona and ask you if it covered your expenses while you were traveling around, would it that then cover transient dental medication?
I didn't know that was coming, but I knew someone was coming transcendental. Oh, you're so funny.
That's an old one, but I like them.
I never heard it, so it's new to me.
Okay.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so let's see. Your job is to do the forgiveness work. The Holy Spirit knows if it's appropriate for you to change dimensions of time. And that's what happens, is that you shift dimensions of time and move into a different timeline wherein that did not happen. That does not occur. And the more you forgive, the more you move into dimensions of time where you're no longer seeing the grievances and the guilt and the fear and the sickness, and you're actually seeing the truth about what is happening here and getting closer to a reality wherein there is no sickness, death, or fear. And you know, it all has to do with your state of mind.
Yep.
It shifts everything, and now you can be living in a happy dream because you're no longer suffering. And you've chosen that. That was a choice. Okay, so, Artin, we say all this so you'll understand why Harish had a certain kind of personality and potentially harmful situations he felt drawn to. But his cousin, Padmaj, was different. Padmaj wasn't as interested in the temporal experiences of the world and wanted to attain enlightenment. They were born to be this way, Lady Gaga, because of the ego's plan to divide and separate them. They'd already learned a great deal together at other times, and the ego, at the level of the unconscious, felt very threatened and planned to get them apart to part ways. When he was old enough, Harish would go into the town that was about an hour's walking distance from the village. He liked to have a good time drinking rice wine, gambling, and flirting with women. He always asked Padmaj to come with him. Padmaj wasn't very interested in fun and games, but Harish was his only friend as well as his cousin, and he wanted to be with him rather than feeling left out and lonely. So in the illusion, you have the duality of Padmaj seeking to be holy and Harish seeking to be worldly. You can add to that the complication, turn the page, that because of their studies at a young age, as well as their Lao Tzu experience, they both already knew a basic truth. As Hindus who believed in Advaita Vedanta, they saw the absolute reality, which they called Brahman, as having nothing to do with the physical world. Atman, which means soul, was thus understood in two ways by them. One was illusory, the other was real. The illusory Atman was the individual soul, the one that seemed to be separate from everyone and every illusory thing. Then there was the Atman of Brahman, or reality, and the absolute reality was only oneness. But at the same time, many Eastern thinkers, even though they considered the phenomenal world to be illusory, still saw it as being a reflection of their gods. This helped perpetuate the popular confusion that a god or gods made the illusion, which a perfect being would actually have nothing to do with. The projection of the universe of multiplicity is a product of the ego, based on the idea of individuality and separation. And I just wanted to say something and go back to in this paragraph where he says, reality has nothing to do with the physical world. Atman, which means soul, was thus understood in two ways by them. One was illusory, the other was real. The illusory Atman was the individual soul. And the reason I keep saying that is because, you know, in when Helen first was taking down the course, she used the word soul in many places and was later told by Jesus in the clarification of terms, which there's a reason that people who don't study the FIP version of A Course in Miracles don't understand that Jesus told them to take out the word soul, which as we see right now actually means an illusory being, an illusory state of the ego. He said, take out the word soul, except where it is a biblical reference, and put in the word spirit instead. Because what has happened, and this is not the reason I think, but this is what has happened, is that people reading the earlier versions and seeing the word soul say things like, Ken Wapnick took the soul out of A Course in Miracles. That, you know, somehow the soul, which is an individual being, which has an individual relationship with God, has been removed from A Course in Miracles and therefore made it invalid. When in reality, taking out that word soul, taking out the idea that there is a special certain individual being that God recognizes as me and you, my soul and your soul, that's impossible and it couldn't be. So the word soul really talks about an illusory being, not the truth of what we are. And, you know, I'm just bringing that out because you hear this from many, many, many people who study the course is, you know, that they're angry because they accuse Ken of taking soul out of the course, when in reality, if they had the whole material, including the clarification of terms, they would see that it was Jesus himself who said, take that out because it is confusing. And it is pointing to something that's not real.
Yeah, it all sounds kind of fishy to me, because if you take the soul out just for the halibut, then there's no reason for it, right?
I knew when you said fishy, there was something going on there. Oh my gosh! Okay, well for that now you get to read.
Okay. Gary, I like the way they put it in the movie The Matrix. The world you see is an illusion to pull the wool over your eyes and prevent you from seeing the real world. Arden, yes, but the real world they were talking about had nothing to do with God. Still, what the movie was saying was that there was a step. What the movie was saying there was a step in the right direction. Gary, by the way, I'm sorry about the mistake I made regarding Shankara. Arden, nope. No problem, my brother. Considering all the information we give you, you've made very few mistakes, just a couple of minor ones. For example, you told the same joke in two different books, which Mikey pointed out to you. Note, Mike Lemieux, also known as Giddy Up Mikey, is a good friend of mine who knows my books extremely well, maybe better than I do. He's the author of Dude, Where's My Jesus Fish? He also facilitates my fan page at Facebook and writes many excellent observations. And Mikey's also a good friend for me too. In fact, when he was in various study groups in Southern Oregon when I lived there a few years ago, he would typically the part when we were reading Gary's work, he would come in, and when we were reading the course, which, you know, he didn't resonate to as much as Gary's work, he would kind of hang out, you know, nearby and just kind of wait until we were talking about Gary's stuff again. which is fine, of course. Anyway, at one point, Mikey, aka Giddy Up Mikey, had all these quotes he'd pulled out of, Gary's books. And I said, well, you know, you've got enough for a book there. And he said, yeah, I guess I do. And I said, well, you probably should write a book. And I think that might have been one catalytic, you know, event that helped consider writing a book. And of course, the rest is history. And he has done a great job with that book. If anybody hasn't read it, it's a lot of fun. And his sense of humor comes across very, very loud and clear, as well as just a wonderful collection of Gary's quotes from his first couple of books. So yeah, I highly recommend Dude, Where's My Jesus Fish if you haven't read it. So Anyway, do you want to continue from there?
Oh, sure. And I agree with that with Mikey's book. And also, he was a great contributor to the DU website, the Yahoo group for a long time. And he's kind of moved on to other things, but he did, you know, put those quotes in every day, and people really appreciated all of
that. Absolutely.
They missed it when he was gone. But, we can't have everything. Anyway, so Gary says, what other mistakes did I make? Arten, in DU, you had a saying there was an earthquake in China in the 1960s that killed over 500,000 people. Actually, it was the 1970s. No big deal. The recording we allowed you to make at the time wasn't very clear, and you couldn't channel as well between visits back then. Also, you got the length of Jay and Mary Magdalene's marriage right, 15 years in DU, but in Love Has Forgotten No One, you made a mistake of taking your notes and listening to us at the same time, and you said that they got married when they were in their 20s. Actually, it was when they were in their teens. Jay was 18 and Mary was 15. When they were married for 15 years up until the crucifixion, that's about it. Nothing fatal. And, of course, it's all illusion anyway, so what the heck, you know.
I think that's just a funny phrase, nothing fatal, which is true, right? Yeah, nothing real can be threatened here.
Well, and you know what, that might have been another timeline. You know, that's between Jesus and Mary Magdalene, or that may have been another timeline when there was a earthquake in China. But it also says something too about Gary's work, because, you know, Gary could have easily gotten on the internet and went and checked it out and said, you know, what is it that, you know, are these guys really telling the truth? But, you know, he didn't. He took his thoughts and he wrote them down. And, you know, later finding out maybe there was differences, but, you know, there's always differences when it comes to these ideas of when things happened, because they didn't. You know, so it's all
it's all a subjective interpretation of a dream, isn't it? Yeah,
exactly, because nothing ever happened. So so nothing fatal. I love that, nothing fatal. Getting back to our two friends, Harish and Padmaj, they had done their homework when it came to studying the ancient texts, and they had been handed down through the generations. They understood the kinds of things they were talking about intellectually, but they were not experiencing it. They hadn't yet developed the discipline in that lifetime to engage in the kind of practice that trains the mind. One night, the two of them went to a drinking and gambling house, and Harish was having a good night, winning a fairly large amount of money. Then an intoxicated man who was losing suggested that Harish was cheating. He wasn't cheating, but it was a serious accusation that Harish didn't take kindly to. Voices were raised, and soon a fight broke out. Padmaj came to help his friend, but during the fight, he was stabbed with a knife in the abdomen. Harish was horrified, realizing immediately that his foolish ways may have just resulted in his best friend and cousin dying. Fortunately, people who worked at the place managed to break up the fight. Harish and a couple of the gamblers took Padmaj to a nearby doctor who practiced what you today would call Ayurvedic medicine. The wound wasn't that deep, and the doctor knew what to do. Padmaj survived and was back to normal health in a few weeks. This, however, was a jolting wake-up call for Harish. He hadn't felt like his way of life was a sin, and he still didn't. But he did have the realization that it was a waste of time, which he felt could be even worse. Also, and this is where you'll remember that there's no such thing as an accident, the doctor, whose name was Sabal, had time to talk to both Harish and Padmaj in the weeks he would visit their village for Padmaj's treatments. He told them about a holy man who they should visit, and even before Padmaj was completely healed, the two made a decision to go out and find this man if this man had something to offer them. Excuse me. They left the village to find the holy man, who Sabal had said had no name. The holy man had once told Sabal that to have a name would limit him to being a human being, which he did not consider himself to be. Intrigued, Harish and Padmaj went to the area where they were told the man with no name would probably be. On the way there, they came across a group of people who were following a different man who they saw as being holy. They are invited to camp out with the group, which today you would call a cult. They were given a small amount of food and asked if they would like to take part in one of the group's ceremonies. There didn't seem to be anything going on that would be harmful, and they agreed. The ceremony consisted of drinking liquid from a bowl that was being handed around by the leader. The liquid was very similar to what you today would call ayahuasca. Aha! The two visitors just saw the drinking as a social thing, part of a ceremony. But soon they found out, when the acid kicked in, the people there were beginning to have unique experiences. At first they would purge, which is a nice word for vomit, and then they'd begin to hallucinate. Gary, I've talked with several people the last few years who told me they had interesting experiences with ayahuasca. Some of them just called it the plant. As you know, since you're always aware of what I'm doing, I've never taken it. But some of these people describe deep intuitions about their childhood and spiritual realizations they seem to think are valuable. What do you think about that kind of stuff? Okay, and so he's bringing up something that I think is probably pretty interesting to most people in this community, because there are people who will go and take these drugs. I personally don't like to throw up, so I've never been tempted to take the ayahuasca or do anything with that. But I've taken LSD plenty, and I think it's a different kind of thing. But it's still. The last time I took LSD was, it's just been a couple of years ago. I went to a festival with, a few friends and one of the friends said, I would like to, do trip with you, take acid with you. And I hadn't done it for years. I mean, not since I was a kid. I said, sure, I'll try that. So we got some and we took it. And what I noticed, I didn't really have any kind of experience. It was just like the same thing to me. I kind of got a little bit of ache in my neck and a little bit of dryness in the throat. But my thinking was just the same as it ever was. I didn't have any shift in that. And I thought, well, maybe this is just not any good. But this other person was just having a great experience. And I said, well, it must be okay. It must be good acid. It's just, my mind isn't the same. My brain doesn't think the way it did or, whatever. I'm not seeing things the way that I used to. And, so what we did, we had a little area set up and a campfire, and I was just sitting there at the campfire. And what happened was that a lot of people started coming, and people would come and just sit down around the campfire and ask me questions. And I was just sitting there basically teaching them A Course in Miracles, telling them what the course says. And, they were thinking I was some kind of wise old woman. And in reality, I'm just me being here, being me, and nothing is different. Anyway, I wonder if ayahuasca would do the same thing. Which, again, I would try it, except for I don't like the throwing up part. So, but the other thing, too, is that people will think, well, you're introducing some foreign thing into your brain or foreign thing into your thinking, and therefore that's responsible for what it is that you're thinking. And the truth is, no, what is in your mind is in your mind already. You are everything, and everything is already here. And so, you can take a drink of something or take a drug or do any kind of practice. You can meditate for, 2 years on a mountaintop. You can do all kinds of things. Nothing is ever going to come into you from outside of you because everything is already inside of you. And so all you're ever going to see is your own self. No matter what you think it is, no matter how you interpret it, it still is only just what you are. And so, I could, probably take, 12 hits of acid, I don't know, and not have any kind of real different experience. I wouldn't try it. I'm not interested in it. But, I just recognize that nothing's going to change what's already going on. Anyway, so that's what I think about it, and I haven't read what Art and Impersa have to say about it.
Or as George Harrison said, nothing's going to change my world. And I have to admit, though, I have still continued to use a highly addictive substance, which is called water. And it maintains this vast illusory network that I call the world. But I'm gradually weaning myself, not from water, but from the need to make the world real. So I think we're all in the same boat here.
Yeah, I think so. So you want to read?
Sure. Arden, Gary.
Oh, wow,
the end of
it's done. Look, it's 9:29 already.
Oh, it's actually fine. Should we just stop it's there?
Yeah. Let's mark. Okay. Let's put the bookmark and read. I'm glad I looked at the clock.
Yeah. Okay. So we can start with Gary at the end of the day next time then.
Yes.
Okay.
Sounds good. All right. Great. Thank you so much,
Lynn. Likewise.
And I encourage everyone, go check out the new FACIM website. Uh-huh. That's facim.org. Uh-huh. And the new FIP website should be coming up pretty soon. And
we're working on it.
I'm happy, man. And there's been a lot of talk about, you know, what's going on with the foundation and the shifts and changes that are happening. And it really is all for the best. I mean, obviously, or it wouldn't be happening. I think that some of these alliances that are being made, these people that are now coming together that were once enemies or had, you know, ideas about the validity of each other's teaching, I think we're coming to see that really nothing real can be threatened and nothing unreal exists. As the beginning of this particular section said, you know, it's the same thing. It always has been. So, you know, the peace of God is staying in the middle. That's it. All righty. Thank you so much, Bruce Rawls. I love you, brother. And I'll see you next
week. Have a great week, all.
All right. Bye-bye. And I'm going to let go of the mic and turn it over to Iris.
Bye for now.
Thank you, Lynn. Thank you, Bruce. And I caught like the last few minutes. I thought it was a